Welcome to CHMA Talks. Today we're talking about New Brunswick's mystery brain disease. A Mount Allison researcher has put the wheels in motion for a study looking into New Brunswick's mystery brain disease. Math and computer science professor Matthew Betty wants to survey and study the cluster of cases being investigated as related to a possible new neurological disorder. Betty specializes in infectious disease modeling and has worked for Health Canada throughout the COVID-19 pandemic. Tonight on CHMA Talks, we talk with Betty about his proposed new study. And after that, we'll have a conversation with journalist Matthew Halliday, who has written about New Brunswick's mystery disease and the province's lack of information sharing regarding it for The Walrus magazine. First, here's my conversation with Mount A researcher Matthew Betty. Matt Betty, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
So you, we've got you here today to talk about this potential new neurological disease that seems to be surfacing in New Brunswick. But perhaps you can introduce yourself and give me some background on the work you do on the other disease that is top of mind for New Brunswickers recently.
Yeah, for sure. I'm Matt Betty. I'm an assistant professor at Mount Allison University. My specialty is mathematical biology. I look at modeling biological phenomena, particularly infectious diseases in animal populations or human populations. I am an advisor for Health Canada and have been for modeling COVID forecasting for the last couple of years. And now I would like to do some modeling on this new potential cluster of disease in New Brunswick.
Right. You've proposed that we need some independent study of this cluster of cases because there's some contention over what it may or may not be. Why do you think the independent nature of the research is important?
I think, as we've seen over the last 2 years, something as simple as a communicable disease can be highly politicized very easily. I think it's important to make sure that the science is done right without influence or undue influence of politics or outside interests. This is mostly why I think independent research is important. And I think the academy or academia is well placed. And in fact, that's part of the reason why we have this infrastructure that is academia, is to do ideally unbiased, independent research for which, you know, you will not see negative consequences from your employer, from government, et cetera. And I believe that's just the best way to get at the underlying science and the underlying information is to work independent of any bodies that may or may not have a vested interest in results turning out one way or another.
Now, Dorothy Shepherd has questioned the validity of the theory that this is a new brain disease that we're looking at. What did you think of that statement and sort of the position that the New Brunswick government has taken so far on this?
Yeah, so far, and this is what motivated me to, you know, I've been playing around with this idea of doing modeling on this for the past year. I'm in some of the support groups for some of the people affected. I've read their stories. I've listened to the things that they say, and I think that uniquely positioned me in a place where I could collect data myself and not rely on, again, external bodies in data collection. Take a real grassroots community approach to the whole thing. And that doesn't answer your question at all. Your question was, what do I think of the conclusions drawn? But I was getting there. It's
take your time.
The conclusions drawn were from the data put forth in that report, because I can only see what you can see, the public-facing report. And from the data put forth in that report, I don't think I would be confident to draw the conclusions she has drawn from that data. And one of the big flags for me is the lack of a control group in that study. There are some statistics in there. I don't want to butcher any of the numbers or misrepresent any of the information in that study, but there are numbers associated with different behaviors in that study. But without knowing the frequency of those behaviors in the general population, I'm not entirely sure how you determine whether something is significant or not in that population.
Right. So there was 48 cases that they looked at, and the interviews were not with all of those, but so there's a number of interviews. Yeah.
Yeah. So there's 34 interviews, and that happens in research all the time. Is research has to be voluntarily done and with informed consent. And so if, the government is able to approach all 48, and if they say, no, I don't want to participate, you can't force it in any way. And so that is not an issue with the study at all. The fact that only 34 participated in the study, that's just the nature of living in a free with an asterisk, I guess, but that's a conversation for a different time, a free society where we have choice in what we participate in and what we don't. The problem is that the study is very narrow. They interviewed 34 people and nobody else. There's nothing to compare to.
Right.
Right. It's very low hanging fruit when you do that. The hope when you do something that narrow is that you get something that 100% of the respondents did. But that's a very, very high bar to fill, mm-hmm. right? 100% means that there's one and only one cause. And anything less than 100% from that report and from the statements of the health minister seems to be interpreted as insignificant. And I think that is a real problem. That's not how good science is done. Again, that may have been a preliminary report, but given the comments from the health minister in press conferences, they seem to be drawing some very strong conclusions from data that doesn't necessarily support those strong conclusions. An example I like to give is if I told you that, say, 60% of people who graduated high school own a dog, that's completely made up. I just made that up. But if I tell you that, you don't necessarily know whether, is 60% high? Is it low? Is it average? We don't know. We don't know because we have nothing to compare it to, right?
Right.
You always need a separate group, a random group of people from that same population, and you have to measure them as well. You can't compare numbers unless you have something to compare to. The survey has done, again, if there was something all 34 had in common with 100, like all 100% of them had this one thing in common, then you could identify that one thing. But a survey that narrow with that few people really precludes, compounding effects or different avenues of transmission or acquiring disease through different avenues.
Wow. Yeah. There's basically when you look at a report like this, and as you said, this is just the public facing information, but I guess what you were thinking is we need to do a lot more work on this, and you've proposed to take a certain path. What are you proposing to do?
So it's very early. I have to keep putting that little asterisk beside it. It's very early, but from what I know of neurological diseases and from people that I've spoken to, many neurological diseases can lie dormant in your system on the order of decades, not necessarily years. So I think it's vitally important to do a survey that stretches very far back in time, very far back in time, and has a very high spatial resolution. It's one thing to know where the patients are now, but if they were exposed to this, say, 5 years ago or 10 years ago, it's important to know where they were as well. And so the survey that we're proposing is much more in depth from than what is public facing on the New Brunswick survey. And that's all I can say because I haven't seen the whole survey, right? It's whatever's publicly facing. Mm-hmm. And so we're proposing to do something that reaches back further in time, reaches back further in space, to try and see if there are any commonalities that may have been overlooked in the initial report.
Right. So you go back with these interviews to decades, and I suppose you'd also be talking about introducing a control sample?
Absolutely, yeah. So if we were going to put out a survey, it would be more than just patients. And again, because of medical privacy, we don't have access to the records of these people. We don't even have access to their names. And that's why it's a very grassroots approach, in that it would be completely voluntary. And in that way, we're actually hoping to capture more people, not just those that were identified as part of this cluster, but suspected cases, people that read these stories and think, well, I had those symptoms. Maybe this is happening to me as well. And as well, people, we will solicit responses from people that aren't experiencing anything out of the ordinary, because that information also helps us determine what behaviors everybody has in common that we could eliminate from potential causes or routes of transmission.
So basically, you're not planning to just sort of get the list of the, you know, the 48 people that are mentioned so far by the provincial government as being listed, and we know that there have been there's different counts now. There's other cases that may fit into this cluster that are not part of that original count. So you're not getting the list from the provincial government or the Department of Health. You're going to go out into the world and solicit people to participate in this on your own. Is that the idea?
That's the idea, and I think that allows the research to really be independent. Right? We're not confined to who was or was not officially diagnosed or labeled as part of this cluster. We can open up our survey to a lot of people, and maybe we'll capture things, and maybe the answer will come from just having a bigger sample size, because 48 people, it's a very small sample size when you're trying to do statistics. Bringing in more people, we can only strengthen any relationships that can be found. If there are any relationships to find, it's very possible that an independent study comes to the exact same conclusion, but it will be done with that knowing that, you know, we've covered all our bases on this. And again, if it's I don't know if I've said this yet, but if anything does come to light, if we gain any knowledge or information, we will happily share it with the community at large, with the provincial government, to help their own studies.
Now, you are a mathematician, and so it's interesting. Yes. Epidemiology is one of these disciplines that involves a number of different types of thinking, but that's very math heavy. I'm curious about how does studying an emerging disease relate to the kind of work you do with known diseases like COVID-19? Are there big differences when you're looking at an emerging disease versus something that's known?
Yes and no. There is in the types of questions that we need to ask, but in terms of the analysis and the mathematics involved, it's surprisingly similar. Over the course of mathematical epidemiology and mathematical modeling of infectious diseases, many, many models, which we use the term model, but it's really just a set of equations, have been proposed and have been shown to approximate the real world. For different scenarios, we have equations that approximate, you know, person-to-person transmission. We have equations that approximate sexually transmitted diseases. diseases that go through an animal host before they reach another human, something like malaria. We have models and equations that deal with environmental exposures that lead to communicable diseases in humans. We have all these tools. And so the idea is that these tools don't necessarily care if you're running time forward or backward. And so when we have a whole bunch of these models and we have data to compare the output of these models to, we can take our data, fit the models to the data so that we know we're looking at the right scenario, and then we can run backward in time and see which one of these models or which combination of these models will most likely result in the data that we see now. And so it's like forecasting backwards in time instead of forward.
Now, is this is something that you've mentioned, it's early days and you're looking for approval to move forward with this. Is this something that's going to require significant funding or what are the sort of question marks that you have going forward in planning this?
Yeah, so funding not so worried about, because again, the community, at least of the people affected, is very strong. They're a great, great group of people. And they are very enthusiastic about an independent study into this. And so, there's not a lot of funding necessary to solicit people, because a lot of them are coming to me because they're very interested in this. Funding, I'm not super worried about. It's just a survey with digital communications and with Canada Post, very cheap to send out a survey and receive a survey. And mathematics, one of the beauties of math is that it itself is very cheap. We don't require large labs. We don't require a lot of specialized material. We need pens, papers, and computers, and we can do a lot. Funding-wise, I don't see any real big hiccups moving forward.
Do you have a timeline in mind as to when it might start?
Yeah, so, these ethics approvals usually take a few months, and that largely depends on whether I filled out all the paperwork correctly. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of I's to dot, T's to cross, right? Everything has to be above board when it comes to ethical approval when you're dealing with humans, because all research needs to be done with compassion, right? And with first and foremost the needs and of the participants involved. And so that can take a few months, and then analysis is really up in the air. It depends on what we can or cannot find. It could be that we do a survey and look at the data and something obvious jumps out, or it could take a very deep and inspired analysis to maybe see something. So the timeline, hopefully, is a year-ish, but that is nothing more than a guess at this point.
Okay. And that would be a year to when you're having results back or getting started?
Oh, no, having results back. I'm hoping to get started by, April, May, June, depending, again, on how good I am at filling out paperwork, which, right. Yeah, depends on the day with me.
All right. Okay, well, I mean, we'll stay tuned, I guess, and look forward to your results. And I just a recap, this idea for this study came in response to what's happening here. It's not necessarily because you either agree with the people who believe there is a new disease happening or you disagree with the government who's saying there perhaps isn't. It's because you feel like there's not enough data out there and we need to study this more.
Absolutely. It may sound cold, but I have no stake here. I'm interested in this because it's anomalous and it falls into my wheelhouse, where the tools that I know and the expertise I have may be able to shed some light on it. And it is very much an intellectual curiosity, which is driving this. And that is, I think, what usually drives really good science. It just so happens that it has the potential for helping people. It has the potential for increasing medical knowledge, all of these extra things. But at my core, I'm intellectually interested in this anomalous behavior. I wouldn't be confident drawing the conclusions that were drawn when I read that report. I'm not confident even forming an opinion one way or another without first doing any work at all. From what I can see, it seems like there's a cluster of cases that can't be diagnosed from what the media has been reporting. But I'm not looking for one way or another. As much as any mathematical modeling and analysis can help determine a cause, it also has this really good property where it can start to eliminate possible causes. And if you eliminate all of them and there's nothing left, then that's the conclusion you must draw.
Right. Right. So even if it doesn't end up identifying something, it might just narrow the field of what we're looking at and what we're considering.
Yeah. In my head, the absolute minimum result that I'm hoping for is, or not hoping for, that I envision is either, there's nothing to look at, or look at these things. If you're going to focus efforts, focus them here instead of doing a broad survey. Because, doing actual testing, getting field work done is very expensive, or can get very expensive very quickly. It's much easier and cheaper and faster to do it on a computer or with pen and paper first.
All right. Well, thanks very much, Matt Betty, and we wish you luck with this project, and I look forward to hearing the results.
Great. Thank you so much. Always a pleasure to talk to you.
You're listening to CHMA Talks on CHMA 106.9 FM in Sackville, New Brunswick. That was mathematician and researcher Matt Betty of Mount Allison University. Next up tonight, we bring you a related conversation. Matthew Halliday is a journalist based in Halifax who tackled the story of New Brunswick's mystery brain disease in a piece in the Walrus magazine in October of last year. I called up Halliday to find out more about the strange story he ended up telling. Matthew Halliday, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
So you've been reporting in the Maritimes for a number of years. Tell me a bit about yourself and your work here.
Sure. Yeah. I'm just a freelance journalist based out of Halifax. Focus on a lot of science and environmental writing. And I guess that's sort of the about me. I got interested in this story last year. I guess part of it as a freelance journalist, I was looking into stories I could report without leaving the region, given COVID and travel restrictions and all of this sort of thing. And of course, this is something fascinating that was right in our backyard.
Yeah, it certainly is.
Yeah. And at first I thought of it as simply a science story, to look into who are these researchers and who are these scientists who are trying to figure out what is causing this cluster of illness. I started to look into it and the story started to sort of expand before me in ways that I really didn't anticipate.
Right. It's enough of a mystery, just this, the existence of this investigation on its own. As you explored it, there was, I guess, different angles that appeared.
Yeah. So as I said, I was really looking into, let's look at this cluster of neurological disease and you know, there's a really fascinating history of these kinds of neurological disease clusters. You know, the most famous one, which has come up in a lot of the coverage of this, happened in Guam many years ago and persisted for decades, maybe longer. And then there have been others around the world as well. And when I talked to one particular senior scientist with the Public Health Agency of Canada, you know, this person suggested that this was potentially, you know, a comparable in terms of the number of people who seem to be infected. Or affected, I should say, not infected. It's not a virus, and the sort of severity of it.
Mm-hmm.
And so there was this, you know, early thinking that maybe this is another one of these once in a blue moon neurological disease clusters that kind of ends up in the literature. So yeah, the idea was okay. Let's see how then a group of epidemiologists and a group of you know, top researchers and neurologists and neurological disease experts. How do they try and crack this? How do they figure out what's going on?
Right. You spoke to people who suffered from the unexplained condition or illnesses. What kind of things were they experiencing?
Well, they were experiencing things like the symptoms began very often sort of inconspicuously and then developed very quickly. Behavioral changes, sleep disturbances, pains and aches and pains that were inexplicable. Then they became often visual disturbances, which were in some cases hallucinatory. And then, you know, you'd see memory difficulties, you know, cognitive problems, muscle wasting, ataxia, which is a sort of difficulty balancing. Yeah, visual and auditory hallucinations, and then eventually, you know, sort of full-blown dementia. And there wasn't necessarily any particular order in which these symptoms appeared, but there was sort of a grouping of symptoms that was roughly in common, that this cluster sort of roughly had in common.
I'm curious to find out that, you know, as you progressed in this story, you mentioned it sort of, things sort of took a turn. At what point did that happen?
Well, I guess it was in June, really, when I started to think, okay, I'm going to try and get in touch with Dr. Marrero, who was the sort of, you know, lead neurologist looking into this in New Brunswick and who was running the Mind Clinic out of the Georgemont. So I thought, okay, I'm going to talk to him. I'm going to talk to the Public Health Agency of Canada. I'll talk to the Canadian Institutes of Health Research, Dr. Neil Cashman, who was involved in this this kind of early investigation based out of UBC, University of British Columbia. I was thinking, I'm going to talk to all these people who are getting involved in this and again, try to really plug into the inner workings of how an investigation like this unfolds. Unfortunately, I sort of hit a wall. All my inquiries were redirected back to New Brunswick, Public Health New Brunswick. Everyone I tried to reach out to declined to speak, in some cases suggesting that they were not being allowed to speak. One scientist said that they were being muzzled and that others were also being muzzled. That was the word they used. And it really sort of, I guess, blew open for me when in June, I was able to reach by sort of non-official means a scientist in the federal public health infrastructure who was able to open up anonymously about what was going on. And basically what they revealed is that, which has been reaffirmed by some subsequent reporting as well, that there was a joint investigation underway between the Public Health Agency of Canada and federal collaborators and New Brunswick, which was in June sort of put on ice, basically, while New Brunswick sort of retrenched and went sort of basically started to pursue its own internal investigation and eschewed the expertise that was on offer from the federal level and to some degree that was coming in internationally as well.
Right. Yeah. And that happened just that was just a few months after basically this became public, because there was a memo distributed in New Brunswick that everyone started to realize, where they described sort of these symptoms, I guess, in a way to encourage people to report cases
to take note if they had patients who were presenting any of these symptoms. The basic timeline, you know, I guess it was late 2020 or early 2020. No, sorry, late 2019, early 2020. That the Public Health Agency of Canada and Dr. Marrero were sort of and various federal collaborators were working on sort of defining this cluster. And this is something that I think is important. It often gets lost in the reporting on this. It's often presented as Dr. Marrero as his cluster or something, somehow the product of his thinking alone. And it's, I think, important to kind of pull out the fact that this cluster of disease was initially, some of the initial patients were identified by Dr. Marrero, but it was really brought to then, you know, many of these people, all these patients were referred to the Creutzfeldt-Jakob disease surveillance system at the Public Health Agency of Canada because their symptoms were so similar to this condition called Creutzfeldt-Jakob, which is the human manifestation of bad cow disease. And we have a national surveillance system for this because it's a very scary disease and we don't want to let it take hold anywhere. So they were all referred to that system. And then, you know, Dr. Marrero, along with, this was a very the number of people being referred and the kinds of symptoms they were experiencing over such a short time span was, again, in the words of the senior scientist I spoke to within federal public health infrastructure, was unprecedented. This was a very strange and unusual cluster. There was really no sort of explanation off the top of their heads, I guess, they could think of for this. So they collectively over a fairly long period of time, you know, looked at these patients, did workups on these patients, really tried to did an exhaustive litany of testing on these patients to really try and find out, figure out what was going on. And they were seeking alternate diagnoses. So this cluster was really the product of Dr. Marrero's thinking, but also the product of thinking from federal scientists and collaborators and with the Public Health Agency of Canada. So yeah, not to go off on a tangent, but I think it's really important to sort of pull that fact out.
Yeah, no, that is an important point because right now I think on the provincial website on this, they sort of have a statement. They don't say this is sort of a figment of Dr. Marrero's imagination, but they do sort of say these are all Dr. Marrero's patients, you know, and they kind of lay that out there as if there's. But I guess the call had been to refer people to Dr. Marrero as well, in addition, like so. As you say, the original snowball may have been his. But it grew beyond, I guess, just his patients.
And some of the top sort of experts on this in the country were involved in defining this cluster and in suggesting there's something more here, more than meets the eye, and certainly more than just a cluster of you know, normal run of the mill neurological disease.
So one of the mysteries to this, besides the obvious mystery of like, what the heck is this disease and where is it coming from, is why would New Brunswick sort of make this change in course? Did you find out anything along those lines? You do say in your piece, New Brunswick has long exhibited a penchant for paternalism and secrecy on matters of public health, which I think that has a fair amount of support. But do you think that's what's going on here? It's just sort of they're predisposed to close things down to public scrutiny, or what have you discovered on that front?
I feel like yes. Now this is sort of my this is speculative, so this is obviously not, you know, this is not a fact, but there is a history. I think some of the pieces some of the examples I pull out are, you know, there was the strange kind of secrecy around the Legionnaires' disease outbreak in Moncton in 2019, which ended up being traced back to an organogram plant. There was obviously the issue with the Eilish Cleary's dismissal, the former chief medical officer of health in 2015, which we still don't know exactly what happened there. And there was a lot of speculation around what was happening there. Mm-hmm. Issues around water quality at Parley Beach and a lot of the opaque sort of response to that. There's a lot of that. I think my gut feeling on this is that, there's a couple of points here. One thing is that around the neurological disease, there's already been a lot of, there's a lot of mistrust. I think from New Brunswickers as to the relationship between industry and government. And you see a lot of people who are sort of advancing almost sort of conspiracy theories around, oh, this company or that company or this particular powerful family must be involved and the government is covering up for them. Mm-hmm. I don't really think there's any evidence for anything like that. But I think that does speak to sort of an inherent mistrust. My feeling on this is that there is just a penchant for keeping things in-house, keeping things secret. wanting to have a control over the messaging. And I think there's in all likelihood, public health authorities in New Brunswick probably don't want federal investigators to come sort of traipsing through the province and testing water and testing food and finding who knows what. And it might simply be a fear of, not that they're covering up for something that is, that they know what it is, but that they don't want, and again, this is pure speculation, but that they are concerned about what might be found, basically.
Right. Like there's a bit of a fear of exposing anything environmentally related in a way.
Yeah, I think that's what a lot of people feel right now. And the idea is, well, we're going to deal with this in-house and we'll figure it out. Mm-hmm. And we don't need help.
Yeah. There's been the province has done a survey to date. We know we just spoke to a researcher here at Mount A, Matt Betty, who's proposing to do a broader study in and survey involving control groups and that sort of thing. From the people that you spoke to, especially before sort of New Brunswick closed up its communications, what should we be doing, or what should New Brunswick be doing, or you know, Public Health Agency of Canada or Public Health New Brunswick be doing to figure this out?
Well, I think you know there's obviously one of the big things that is constantly coming up is environmental testing. So going out into the field and trying to figure out if there's an environmental contaminant. Okay, what is it? So testing water, testing food, testing soil, et cetera. I think, you know, one of the responses from the New Brunswick government has been, okay, we've got this epidemiological survey that was conducted, and this was something that was put together in part with the Public Health Agency of Canada before their involvement was sidelined. And, you know, that revealed that there was no commonality. You know, in talking to federal level sources, you know, it's interesting to hear the different take on that. Essentially, that survey that epidemiological questionnaire that was conducted with only about 2/3 of the current cluster was really intended as a starting point. It was designed to generate hypotheses, not answer questions, not be definitive in any way. So, you know, I think it found that, you know, 91% of the people who are in this cluster or who answered the questionnaire in any case had consumed lobster within a certain period of time, you know, before the onset of their symptoms. You know, and then there were other commonalities as well. But then I think public health sort of explained, well, it couldn't be lobster because people in other provinces or in Maine eat lobster. So the kind of, I guess, quality of the questionnaire was rudimentary. It was, mm-hmm. it was a hypothesis generating questionnaire, not something that was designed to generate answers. The sources that I've spoken to federally, suggest strongly that it's the results are being used incorrectly. Essentially, they're being used to answer questions rather than pursue new avenues of investigation. So you can think, if 91% of people said I've eaten lobster within such and such period of time before generating symptoms, maybe that means that, you know, they should go test lobster. And that's only one. Not that I'm saying it's lobster, but that's just one example.
Right. Yeah. Or at least find out, you know, where they ate it, how they ate it, and you just continue on from there. It's not enough to draw a conclusion one way or another.
Exactly.
Are you continuing to follow this story? Will you be? Will we see further work from you on this?
I am. Yeah. Hopefully, there's CBC has been doing some good work and investigation on this in the past little while, and other reporters as well. I'm really looking to kind of I'm hoping to kind of take a step back, observe how things play out over the next few weeks, and I'm hoping to do something a little bit, not another big feature, but something a little bit more in depth once some more information comes out. The province is supposed to be releasing its kind of final report. I think they were hinting that it was going to happen soon, maybe even this month. I don't know if the kind of size of the Omicron wave is, directing public health's attention elsewhere, but we were supposed to hear about that pretty soon. And I'm really going to be curious to hear the response from some of the people, the federal level folks who were previously involved in the investigation, because they've been very mum about this over the past few months as they wait to learn more about the about what the province reveals, and it will be interesting to see if they have anything to say after the fact.
All right. Well, yeah, you've given us some great perspective on it. I really appreciated that walrus piece, and yeah, I look forward to reading the next thing you write about this.
Great, thank you so much.
And thanks for your time today, Matthew. Appreciate it. You've been listening to CHMA Talks. If you missed part of the conversation and want to hear more, check out the on-demand section at chmafm.com. Tune in again next week for conversations near and far about stuff that matters. I'm your host, Erica Butler. Thanks for listening.